Few political assassinations have involved targeting a single, specific, and entire family. But when power is handed down within bloodlines from generation to generation, one way to effect political change is to eliminate the family to which the power belongs. That was the case in 1918 for the House of Holstein-Gottorp-Romanov in Russia. In 1917, Russia was not only fighting in World War I, it was also heading into its own civil war. Tsar Nicholas II had been in power since late 1894, titled Emperor and Autocrat of all the Russias. However, in 1917, he was on the military front and apparently losing touch with the tremendous suffering of his Russian people back home. Nicholas had left his wife, Alexandra, in charge of ruling from the capital, Petrograd, better known as St. Petersburg. But many Russians despised Alexandra because she was from Germany. She had been born Victoria Alex Helena Louise Beatrice, or Alex of Hesse for short, and was part German and part English. In fact, she was one of the granddaughters of England's Queen Victoria. During World War I, Russia was part of the Allied forces, along with the British Empire and France, later to be joined by Japan, Italy, and ultimately the United States by 1917. Germany was part of the opposing Central Powers. For this reason, some Russians even thought Alexander was a German spy in their midst. She was also one of the female carriers of the so-called royal hemophilia that afflicted several European ruling families that were descendant from Queen Victoria. After providing the imperial family four daughters, Alexandra finally gave birth to the couple's only son, Alexei, who was hemophiliac. Although they tried to keep Alexei's disease a secret, once it was known, it proved to be yet another reason Alexander was not liked by the Russians, having brought the, quote, English disease to their throne. She also became very close to the unusual Russian mystic and faith healer, Grigory Rasputin, whom she apparently believed could cure Alexei. Rumor was Alexandra and Rasputin were lovers, or at least that he was too closely controlling her political actions, another reason for Russians to distrust their Tsarina. Rasputin himself was murdered in 1916, a mystery in itself. Internal unrest of the Russian people eventually resulted in the February Revolution of 1917. This led to the establishment of a weak provisional government, the house arrest of the Romanov family, and the forced abdication of Tsar Nicholas II. The Bolshevik, or Red Party, headed by Vladimir Lenin, was rising in Russia. The anti-Bolshevik supporters of the monarchy and the Tsar were known as the Whites. The Bolsheviks took over and imprisoned the Tsar and his family in the old capital of Siberia in the Ural Mountains. But in October of 1917, they moved the prisoners to a facility that the Reds termed the House of Special Purpose in Yekaterinburg. This had become the Red capital. Initially, the Bolsheviks planned to bring Nicholas to trial, but the White Army gained power and in the summer of 1918 began to close in on Yekaterinburg. So the Reds changed their plan. There was just too much to lose if the White Army somehow managed to free the Romanovs and reinstate Nicholas as the ruler of Russia. So on the night of July 16th, 1918, the chief Bolshevik guard at the house where the Romanovs were being held, a man named Yakov Yurovsky, ordered the family doctor to gather the royals and their servants and lead them all to the basement. The family was told that the fighting White and Red armies were getting dangerously close to the house, so they were to be moved by truck in order to protect them. Now, it took a while for the royals to all dress, but shortly they were all assembled into a small basement room with their servants. In total, there were seven members of the Romanov family: Tsar Nicholas, who was 50 years of age, his 46-year-old wife, Alexandra, their four daughters, the Grand Duchesses, Olga, who was 22, Tatiana, age 21, 19-year-old Maria, and Anastasia, who was 17, as well as the couple's 13-year-old son and would-be heir, Tsarevich Alexei. Their four servants included the family physician, maid, valet, and cook. Historical references don't agree on all the details, But the general consensus is that once in the basement room, a couple hours after midnight, so now July 17th, over the rumble of an idling truck out back, Chief Yurovsky told the assembled Romanovs and their servants they were actually there to be executed. The truck engine was a ruse to help muffle the sounds. Yurovsky shot Tsar Nicholas first and then turned his gun on young Alexei. Quickly, a waiting firing squad entered the small room and began shooting the others. Although the executioners were told to aim for the heart, bullets were ricocheting around the room and in some cases seemingly off the bodies of the Romanov daughters. Due to the dangers to the killers themselves, a decision was made to cease fire and bayonet the survivors. When the bodies were checked for signs of life, it was discovered that about 18 pounds of diamonds and other jewels had been sewn into the bodices of the girls' dresses, which was likely what caused the deflected ammunition. About 20 minutes after the first shots, the dead were carried out of the building. Although the execution of the Tsar in particular was quickly publicized in newspapers in Russia, and then around the globe, the gory details were held back. Early accounts made no mention of the murders of the rest of the family. The front page of the July 20th New York Times stated, quote, Nicholas Romanov, ex-Tsar of Russia, was shot July 16th, according to a Russian announcement by Wireless Today. The former empress and Alexis Romanov, the young heir, have been sent to a place of security, end quote. Yurovsky ordered the bodies disposed of where no one could find them, especially not the White Army or other supporters of the Tsar. That way the Bolsheviks could tell whatever story they wanted. Plus, there would not be a single bone found to be used as a martyr's relic by the opposition. The location of the gravesite was to become a well-guarded secret. In fact, almost 20 years later, a Bolshevik official still bragged, quote, the world will never know what we did with them. As you can imagine, though, many different versions of what became of the victims' bodies circulated for years. One 1935 account came from American adventurer and author Richard Halliburton, who traveled to Russia to interview one of the alleged firing squad members named Peter Ermakov. Ermakov told Halliburton he was the man Yurovsky put in charge of finding a good place to get rid of the bodies. He chose an abandoned mine shaft, a dozen miles away from Yekaterinburg. Ermakov said that the day before the killings were to occur, soldiers brought sulfuric acid, gasoline, and firewood and took them deep into the mine in preparation to completely destroy the bodies. This is how Ermakov described this crime scene after the bodies were moved to the truck. Quote, there was blood everywhere and slippers and pillows and handbags and odds and ends swimming around in a red lake. End quote. Ermakov said it took a couple hours to drive to the disposal site. It was there the clothing and jewels were removed from the victims. The valuables were to be sent to Moscow, but the clothing was burned right there at the mine. By that time, though, it was already getting light. So they decided to stash the 11 bodies deep in the mine and wait for sunset that evening to burn them. According to Ermakov, that next night the bodies were moved to the mouth of the mine where layers of logs had been used to create a funeral pyre. They put the bodies on the wood, poured sulfuric acid on the victims, then added the gasoline and set it all ablaze. Ermakov claims to have personally watched to be sure not a piece of physical evidence of the bodies was left. He said if something came off the pile, he pushed it back on and kept adding more gasoline to make sure the fire continued until there was nothing left but ash. He then claimed the ashes were gathered into buckets, which were taken up to a high place and flung into the wind. Then the next day it rained. Here's a quote that Halliburton attributed to Ermakov a little over 15 years after the killings. So if anybody says he has seen a Romanov or a piece of a dead one, tell him about the ashes and the wind and the rain. Despite the Bolsheviks' best efforts, the White Army was able to overtake Yekaterinburg. But sadly for the Romanovs, that was about a week after the murders. When troops found the basement room, the crime scene had been scrubbed clean. Remember, the world didn't yet know the entire family had been killed, and that amount of blood described by Ermakov could not have come from only executing the Tsar. But But at the basement crime scene, there were reportedly what looked like bullet holes in the walls, as well as scratches on the wallpaper, possibly from bayonet blades. Now, members of the White Army had heard about the possible use of the old mine outside of town as the dump site for the bodies. So they rode out there and found the remnants of two bonfires. Sifting through the ashes, they found 65 pieces of physical evidence. Among them were two belt buckles, fragments from two military hats, and other regalia known to be worn either by the Tsar or his son. From the women, they found some jewelry, shoe buckles, hooks and buttons from corsets, and an eyeglass case that was known to be Tsarina Alexandra's. They also recovered an eyeglass lens and an upper denture thought to belong to the doctor. So the clothing was clearly burned there. The remains of a small dog were also found. The family had at least one dog, a little black dog called Artino, while in Bolshevik captivity. But the only trace of human remains they found at the mine was a finger they thought belonged to a middle-aged woman. Perhaps it had been cut off to remove a ring from Alexandra's finger. Or maybe it was blown off of her body, since at least one source indicates grenades were used in a failed attempt to seal off the mine. So although the White Army found evidence at the mine, the bodies themselves were not discovered. Now, among the spin-off mysteries related to the inability to locate the Romanov remains were rumors that some members of the imperial family had survived, especially the children. In the decades following the murders, many imposters arose, claiming to be the surviving children. Now, the most frequent contenders said they were Alexei, heir to the throne. But the most famous imposters were several alleged to be Anastasia, the youngest of the Romanov's four daughters, who was just 17 at the time of the assassinations. One widely held Anastasia possibility was a woman for who at least part of her life was known as Anna Anderson. Following a failed 1920 suicide attempt in Berlin, and after recovering in a mental hospital, Anna claimed that despite some amnesia, she believed she was Anastasia Romanov, sole survivor of the Romanov family. Now, this woman could not speak any Russian, even though the killings had only happened just a few years prior. But some said she did look a lot like the youngest Romanov daughter. So much so, in fact, that some people began to be convinced, blaming any inconsistencies in her story on amnesia related to the trauma of witnessing the killings. Now, many who knew the family well kept insisting that the woman was an imposter. But just to be sure, Tsarina Alexandra's brother organized a background check. The conclusion of the private investigator was that the impersonator was a Polish factory worker named Franziska Szanskowska, who had suffered from mental illness after a head injury at a munitions factory where she worked. Regardless, the woman spent the rest of her days trying to prove and insisting she was the Grand Duchess Anastasia. She traveled around the U.S. and Germany, gaining notoriety and media attention while living off the kindness of supporters and going in and out of asylums and hospitals. Books, plays, a ballet, and movies were written about the possibility or impossibility that Anna Anderson was actually the Grand Duchess Anastasia. In the late 1960s, a Charlottesville, Virginia history professor who took an interest in Anderson's story married her to allow her to permanently relocate to the United States. The pair lived an eccentric life, including a late 1983 episode in which the woman's husband sprung her from a mental facility, resulting in a police alert that spanned 13 states. Anna Anderson, now Manahan, died in Virginia in 1984, aged 82. Her body was cremated the day after her death. Now let's fast forward to 1991, when the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or USSR, collapsed, and some previously unreleased government documents were made public. These offered a different story of the events surrounding the disposal of the Romanov bodies 73 years prior. Apparently, the day after the killings, perhaps because of Ermakov's bragging, Yurovsky, remember, he's the Bolshevik chief guard, he was afraid too many people had heard about the plan to burn the remains of the Tsar and his family out at the old mine shaft that night. So although the clothing had already been burned at the mine, Yurovsky made a last-minute change of plans to get rid of the bodies themselves at an alternate location. But while the remains were being driven from the mine to the new site, the truck got stuck in the mud. So the Bolshevik soldiers were forced to dig a pit and hastily bury the bodies right there along the roadside. They poured sulfuric acid on the victims' faces and covered the bodies with rubble, wooden planks, and the backfill from the hole they had dug. Following the new lead about the disposal site, searchers were looking in one potential area and came across a 6-by-8-foot common grave they immediately suspected contained the Romanov family. Under the direction of Russian authorities, about 1,000 bones and bone fragments were carefully recovered from the shallow pit. However, the burial contained a total of only 9 skeletons, not the 11 that would have accounted for the 7 members of the Romanov family and their 4 servants. Initial anthropology assessments suggested the group consisted of 5 females and 4 males. Now, we anthropologists use pelvic bones, skulls, and other bony landmarks, as well as lots of bone measurements, to judge whether a skeleton is male or female. But we can only do that for adult remains. Well, at least for those individuals who've undergone the typical skeletal changes associated with puberty. The hormones of puberty cause lifelong changes in the skeleton that result in diagnostic features related to a person's sex. So which 4 of the 5 executed males were present, and which 5 of the 6 women were present in that group of 9? For that assessment, the anthropologist looked for signs of age. We can use both skeletal and dental development in particular to gauge the age of younger individuals. We can come up with a fairly tight age range for subadults. For instance, in fetal stages, we can come within months of the age. By the late teens and early 20s, we can often give an age estimation spanning just a few years. Once mature, though, sometimes remains can only be assigned to an overall category, like young adult, middle-aged adult, or older adult. Although often those generalizations can be narrowed down to a couple of decades. When skeletal maturation is complete, we have to look at degeneration and other typical changes that reflect advancing age. Based on the anthropological analysis, all 4 males were adults, so assumed to be Tsar Nicholas, age 50, the 53-year-old family doctor, the valet who was 61, and the 48-year-old cook. None of the skeletons appeared to be from a child, whether male or female, near age 13, which was the age of Tsarevich Aleksei. Because only about 15 years separated the actual ages of the males in the group, to try to figure out which man was which, scientists turned to dental work, which apparently some facts were known about from these men, as well as photographic superimposition. A photo superimposition uses known images of a person and compares them to the skull in question to look for similarities between specific dimensions of the photo and the bones. The skull can be manipulated until it's viewed from the same angle that the subject in the picture was positioned. Then the skull is photographed and an overlay of the 2 images can be analyzed. The comparison focuses on features that don't tend to change over life, like the distance between the eye orbits, the width of the face, and the slope of the forehead. Even how well the ear placement in the photograph of the known subject matches the auditory openings in the unknown skull. As for the 5 female skeletons represented in the 6 possible women, all were from adults, but 2 were obviously older than the others. 2 of the missing women were known to be approximately middle-aged, 46-year-old Tsarina Alexandra, and the family's maid, who was 40. 1 had platinum dental work, and Alexandra's diaries made mention of visits to the dentist. The other skeleton showed substantial wear facets on the bones of her ankles, a sign of working while on her hands and knees, so assumed to be the maid. But the 4 Romanov daughters, the Grand Duchesses, were a mere 5 years apart in age, ranging from 22 down to 17. Fortunately, though, during those years, both skeletal and dental maturation are still being completed. So given a small group of remains, anthropologists can often seriate the individuals in order of age. 2 of those skeletons looked older than the 3rd. and combined with photographic superimposition, were thought to be 22-year-old Olga and 21-year-old Tatiana. The third skeleton showed features suggesting it belonged to either 17-year-old Anastasia or 19-year-old Maria, but scientists brought in from around the world disagreed on that point. A colleague of mine, the late Dr. Bill Maples, was one of the experts who analyzed the remains. Maples said his height estimate put the third young woman at about the same stature as the other two. A photograph of the girls taken about a year before the killings showed Anastasia to be noticeably shorter than either Tatiana or Marie, and slightly shorter than her oldest sister, Olga. Maples found this entry in their mother's diary, written less than a year before the murders. "Anastasia is very fat, like Marie used to be, big, thick-waisted, then tiny feet. I hope she grows more." Now, this supports that the third skeleton was not Anastasia, but the older Marie. In any event, though, the Romanovs' 13-year-old son, Alexei, was definitely missing from the grave, as was one of his four sisters. The next step, as you can probably imagine, was DNA testing. Nuclear DNA was first used in forensics in 1986, so still a relatively recent technique for identification at the time the skeletons were discovered. Particularly new was mitochondrial DNA testing, which is especially useful on hair, bones, and other badly degraded samples where few, if any, copies of nuclear DNA might be found. Although mitochondrial DNA testing wasn't used in court cases until 1996, it was well into studies of its usefulness in identification by the time the mass grave was found. So in 1992, samples were taken from fragments of teeth and bones from the 9 skeletons in the suspected Romanov grave. And that was to be compared with known royal family reference samples. The results, released in 1993, show one set of remains did belong to Nicholas, another to Alexandra, and that 3 were from the couple's daughters. The 4 other skeletons were not related to the Romanovs, so presumed to be their servants. Where did they get the family reference samples? Well, the current Prince Philip, husband of Britain's reigning Queen Elizabeth, is the maternal grandson of Tsarina, Alexandra's sister. In other words, he's the grandnephew of the Tsarina, and his mother would be Anastasia's first cousin. Since mitochondrial DNA is passed from a mother to all of her children, whether male or female, and then through the women down their entire bloodline, Prince Philip's mitochondrial DNA exactly matched Alexandra and those of her daughters. But Nicholas would not have shared the same mitochondrial DNA pattern as his wife and daughters. So confirming his identity required the exhumation of his brother, Grand Duke George, buried in St. Petersburg. George had died suddenly from complications of tuberculosis when he was 28, while out riding his motorcycle in 1899. In addition to George's DNA, samples from living relatives also confirmed one skeleton belonged to Nicholas. That skeletal DNA also matched blood on one of Nicholas's shirts that had been tucked away in a museum since an 1891 assassination attempt that happened in Japan. But one of the imperial couple's daughters and their only son were still missing. Could the youngest 2 children have survived? Could Anastasia wannabe Anna Anderson have really been the Grand Duchess after all? Anderson's body had been cremated, and she had no known children. So how could they get DNA for her? As luck would have it, scientists found a hospital tissue sample that had been kept from an intestinal surgery Anderson had in 1979. They were also able to locate a lock of her hair found in a book belonging to her husband. Not only did those 2 samples match each other, Anderson's DNA showed she was not in any way related to the Romanov family. And remember, a private investigator had been hired by Tsarina Alexandra's family, and he said Anderson was really a munitions factory worker, Franziska Szanskowska. Researchers located the maternal grandnephew of that missing Polish woman, and his mitochondrial DNA was an exact match to the so-called Anna Anderson. Here's another interesting thing about the Romanov grave found in 1991. It had already been discovered by a small group of Russians in May of 1979, a movie producer, an ethnographer, and a couple of geologists. They had creatively petitioned to take soil studies in the area to cover their real intention of locating the grave. They had access to some of Guard Yurovsky's writings, and using those had located the gravesite over 10 years earlier. They even removed three skulls and photographed them at the site, but then, thinking better of it, reburied them at the same place. At that time, even speaking of the Romanov execution was taboo, so amazingly, the group kept their findings a secret until the USSR collapsed. Okay, now let's consider what's known or suspected about the victims' injuries. Halliburton's 1935 publication describes Ermakov's graphic account of the assassinations, including the sequence of the killings and the weapons used. Ermakov said there were initially only three executioners in the room and said that Yurovsky shot Nicholas in the face and the bullet passed right through the Tsar's brain. Then Yurovsky turned and shot Alexei in the head once. Ermakov claimed that he himself shot Tsarina Alexandra in the mouth at a distance of only 6 feet. He then turned his gun on the doctor, who turned away and was shot in the neck. Next, Ermakov said he shot the cook in the body and then in the head while the man was crouching in the corner. Now, someone else in the trio besides Ermakov had already shot the valet by that time. And the third killer, a guy named Vaganov, was repeatedly firing at the girls. Ermakov said no one had apparently yet shot the maid. She was in another corner, covering herself with a couple of pillows that she had brought for the family's alleged truck evacuation. Well, the pillows were also filled with jewelry, deflecting the bullets. So Ermakov said a guard came in from the hallway and used a bayonet on her throat. At that point, the rest of the men rushed in and were repeatedly beating and bayoneting the victims, dead or alive. Rifle butts were used to smash their faces. When they found young Alexei still moaning on the floor, Yurovsky shot him twice more in the head. Ermakov went on to claim that a total of 38 shots had been fired. I don't have any idea why he would be able to be so exact. He even knew the type of ammunition and firearms used. One of the men turned 17-year-old Anastasia over onto her back, and she cried out, so he finished her off with the butt of his rifle. Makes me almost sick to have to speak those details, but it's important to examine how Ermakov's account matches the trauma analysis for at least the nine skeletons recovered in 1991, especially given how he lied about the disposal of the bodies at the mine. The facial skeletons of all nine showed fracturing, confirming they had likely been bashed with rifle butts. The skulls of only three of the individuals showed through and through gunshot wounds. The doctor was shot from left to right through his skull. Perhaps Ermakov only thought he hit the man's neck. Olga was shot in the left side of her jaw and the bullet exited her forehead. So the gun would have had to be below her chin or she was lying on the ground at the time. Tatiana was shot in the back of the head. One definite bayonet wound went through the breastbone of who the Russians claimed was the valet. But Dr. Bill Maples believed that sternum was inventoried to the wrong body and had actually belonged to Tsar Nicholas. A total of 14 bullets were found in the grave, two of which were still lodged in the doctor's remains. The Russian forensic experts agreed that the ammunition matched the types of weapons mentioned in the historic accounts. They also found a grenade detonator in the grave, probably from the activity at the mine. The victim's tooth enamel and skull surfaces also showed evidence of exposure to acid, just as Ermakov's story had claimed. After the forensic analyses, the Romanov family was buried in St. Petersburg in the Imperial Crypt of St. Peter and Paul Cathedral on July 17, 1998, 80 years to the day from the execution, but without the two missing children. Researchers continued to dissect Yurovsky's writings and learned two of the bodies had been burned and buried separately from the others in an attempt to throw off the body count if the White Army discovered the main grave. In 2007, about 70 meters from the site discovered in 1991, metal detectors led investigators to a grave that contained about 44 burned bone fragments and numerous bullets. In 2008, Results of DNA testing showed the two remaining Romanov siblings had at last been found.